Welcome to Radio Gorgeous, women's voices on culture, style, society and well-being. Radio Gorgeous, where women do the talking.
We are here with J. Courtney Sullivan discussing your third novel.
Yes.
The Engagements.
Yes.
And it starts out with the woman who I think in real life, mm-hmm. Mary Frances Garrity,
yes.
was responsible for the strap line that we still see today on De Beers ads, "A diamond is forever."
That's right.
And was responsible and is still responsible for putting an engagement ring, you know, a diamond engagement ring on everyone else but us, but our fingers.
Right, yes.
And that to me, I mean, is, I remember a friend of mine worked for one of the diamond magazines and said, you know, that whole thing about how you have to spend 2 months' salary, that's just made up. And it's like, oh, well, of course it is, just
right.
like everything else.
Right.
But as you were saying, your grandmother's diamond, her ring, that gets passed down.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother had a diamond ring that was my father's mother's and was, you know, given to her. So not only, you know, but that's any family jewelry.
Right, right.
Always gets passed down. But it does lend us this idea that it's this unshakable, long tradition.
Yes. And even the passing down is part of the marketing and the advertising. Mm-hmm. So, you know, one of the things about diamonds is that it's a very complicated, very precise supply and demand channel always, because diamonds actually are not that rare. So, you know, only releasing as many as will be bought. And the diamond industry never wanted there to be a secondary supply of diamonds. So although, of course, you can buy a diamond ring, a vintage ring, most people do keep them in the family. And mm-hmm. even people who get divorced usually keep the ring.
Mm-hmm.
And so it really, it is so imbued with the sentimental value that really all goes back to this very practical reason for why that is. But for us as the consumers, whether it's a diamond ring or some other piece of jewelry, we put so much, you know, so much meaning into those stones that we'll never get rid of them.
Mm. Well, it also, you don't get the money out that you put in anyway
exactly.
when you buy it new.
Exactly, right, exactly.
So you may as well just keep it.
Yes.
But there is always that thing, you know, when you were growing up, looking at your grandmother's massive diamond, you know, on her hand
yes.
and where that had been with her,
yes.
how it came to her.
Exactly.
And
when I started writing the book, I think it came from a lot of different places, but the jumping off point, the real sort of click moment was my best friend, who had always said that she was never going to get married and definitely wouldn't be having a wedding and definitely, definitely wouldn't be wearing a diamond ring, suddenly was engaged, and she didn't have a ring yet and she wanted one. And so she said, we went to brunch one day, and afterwards she said, will you look at rings with me? So we went to this store in New York. It's called Doyle & Doyle. Beautiful store. They sell all just antique estate jewelry. And I'm standing there looking at these beautiful diamond rings and just wondering about them. Like, exactly as you said, I mean, what is the story behind this ring? Who wore this? Why is it here? How did it end up here? And I think that's what really got my wheels turning as to write this book, which is the story of one ring as it moves through a century.
Mm-hmm. There's other stories along there, but there is one ring that moves sort of through about five people's different hands.
Yes. Yeah.
And means such different things through their hands.
Yes.
To each of them. And when I first opened the book, I read the first chapter is from Mary Frances Garrity's point of view, and it's sort of like you're sucked into the world of Mad Men.
Yeah.
You know, it's an advertising agency. She's a female writer.
Yeah.
She doesn't even clock that or consider it wrong. She's paid less. She's, you know, these are, or that as an unmarried woman, an old maid, you know, that she wouldn't get into the country club. That's like normal for her.
Right.
And we see her sort of life change.
Yeah.
And we meet other people in the opening chapters. And I thought it was just going to be these different vignettes.
Mm-hmm.
And then I re-meet these people. I was like, oh, great. Okay, so we're following a bunch of different people. We're keeping on following them.
Yeah.
And so when it really turns into a novel for me after sort of the first part. One of the things I really noticed is that I don't know if you're writing about things you know very deeply or if you're writing through or combination with a lot of research. Because your knowledge of, say, Mary Frances Garrity's world mm-hmm. and the advertising, Philadelphia, country clubs there, what it was like with all of advertising moving to New York, that whole world, to Paris, to Montmartre, to a classical music world, to suburb of Cambridge, Mass, and very working class background, and even down to what it's like, you know, what EMTs were doing then, mm-hmm. as opposed to what they do now. Yes. Tell me.
Okay, thank you. I mean, my first two novels were very much set in worlds that I knew, and the kind of the imaginative part of it came only from writing the inner lives of people who were very familiar to me. So with this one, I wanted to challenge myself a bit more and write about worlds that I didn't know. And it was a lot of research for every character. When I was writing my first two novels, I had a full-time job. I worked as a researcher at the New York Times for one of the op-ed columnists there. So I actually, after I left that job, of course it was always my dream to just write fiction. But when I started to just write fiction, I think I almost missed the research part because there is such a sort of detective aspect to it, you know, really digging in. And one of the things I love about being a writer, fiction writer, and also writing nonfiction, is it really appeals to a nosy type of person, which I am. You know, when you're a writer and you ask someone, please tell me everything about yourself, they do. If you were just a random person on the train asking them, they might say, no, thank you. So for each of these characters, I really kind of tapped into an expert. For James, the paramedic, I was lucky enough to actually ride along with the Cambridge paramedics several times.
Wow.
Yeah, and observe what they were doing. And it was really incredible because I would be sitting there in the back of this ambulance. I was wearing the official, you know, jacket and taking notes and even going into the scenes with them and bringing the patients out. And not a single patient, probably I saw 50, not a single one ever said, you know, who the hell is she? What is she doing here?
You know? Who's the lady with the clipboard?
No one mentioned it.
Yeah.
And that was amazing. And at a certain point, though, as you point out, I realized the technology they have, which is really incredible, wouldn't have existed, of course, in the 80s when James was doing this. So then I had to go back. The ride-alongs were really useful just to see the kind of interpersonal connections between the patients and the EMTs.
And the sort of rollicking emotions that they go through dealing
exactly.
with these scenes and dealing, you know.
Yes, and they also, it's kind of an amazing relationship they have with these patients because they are seeing them at their worst and getting them, you know, sort of stabilized, but then they're done. So I, as a novelist, of course, I want to know, well, what happened next? And they don't ever really know what happened next. And a lot of times they've dropped off a patient in terrible condition, and then they bring five more patients to that same hospital in the course of the night, but it's not like they go back and check on the first one. That's it. It's compartmentalized in that way. But, you know, they would talk to me a lot about the emotions of dealing with really, really intense situations. And sometimes, you know, the situations are just kind of not that big of a deal. Sometimes they're really funny situations. But, you know, usually they can be really intense. So for that, it was mostly just observing and then also interviewing some of the medics who had come on board in the late 70s, as James would have, because they were all sort of working off of techniques that had been established during Vietnam. And so that was James. And then Delphine, the Parisian character, of course, I had to do the hard work of going to Paris and spending a lot of time in her neighborhood. It was very difficult. Yeah.
So I can see why you picked Paris.
Right.
But why Cambridge? You live in Brooklyn, so why Cambridge, Mass?
Why Cambridge? I really wanted to get at, you know, in this book, I wanted to write about all these different kinds of marriage. I wanted to write about marriages between people who came together out of love, marriages of convenience, marriages, you know, all different kinds of marriage. And one of the ways I wanted these people to be really different from one another was in a socioeconomic sort of position.
Yes.
So I wanted, you know, Evelyn, of course, is very wealthy, and this, in a way, influences her happiness in her life. James is...
And also
the
of
opposite.
That same town.
Right, exactly, yeah. And, you know, I think Cambridge is this kind of amazing sort of Tale of Two Cities kind of a place. Actually, it's more like a Tale of Three Cities or more, because you have incredibly poor people living in the streets in Cambridge. You have incredibly wealthy people living in penthouse apartments and these beautiful old homes. And then you also the Charles have River Harvard, and you have and you all have of this. So, like, these guys, they really have to be familiar with all different kinds of people. And they never know. One of these medics I rode around with, he said, you know, the only thing that my patients have in common with one another is that none of them were expecting to see me that day. You know, so they just have to constantly be changing and changing and changing. So I thought that was intriguing from a writing standpoint. And then Frances, I just fell in love with. I read her name in a book called The Heartless Stone, which is a nonfiction book about diamonds. And in that book, there was, I think, a tiny little paragraph that just said, the line, "A diamond is forever," was written in 1947 by a woman named Frances Garrity, and she never married. And I literally underlined it and wrote in the margin, she's the missing link in this book. Wow. And I loved her. And other than that, she had not been written about anywhere. She really hadn't been mentioned. Even though there was quite a bit written about the De Beers advertising campaign, it was almost as if it had written itself, you know?
Yeah, like that came with De Beers.
Right.
You know, it's
right.
Part of, well, and it's part of the cult that they're creating of, like, this has existed forever.
Exactly.
We have existed forever. We are diamonds.
Exactly.
This is, you know, this is how it is.
Yes.
And so it shall be written.
Yes,
you know?
Right. Yeah. And the more I learned about her, the more I felt really eager to get her just right, because I think often when you're reading fiction about a real person, you know, at least for me, I'm always wondering, is that part real? Is that part real? Is that part real? I wanted to be able to say of Frances that everything you read about her is real, and it really is. So, you know, everything she thinks or says is something she actually wrote down in a letter or said in an interview.
And were you able, where did you go to find out, you know, to see her letters, to meet her, as it were.
It was an interesting process, because the other character in the book, Dorothy Dignam, who's her counterpart in the publicity department, Dorothy was the kind of person who was really involved with, like, the women in advertising organization.
Yeah.
And, you know, she made, she put together her own papers and gave them to the archive at Radcliffe. So,
Yeah, she was a real mover and shaker.
She
whereas,
was. And Frances,
you know,
was
Frances,
not.
Yeah, just wanted to do the work.
Yes. And, Frances
know.
Was like a bit more of a loner. You know, she was she was interested in her own career, but she wasn't interested in women, really, you know, furthering the cause of women as a whole. So, like, Dorothy, I mean, she has chronicled, in her papers, she even has short stories she wrote in, like, third grade. She has her diaries starting from when she was a little girl, so it's really kind of incredible. And all of these lists that men, questions that men asked her every day at
that
work,
was great.
Those are real.
Those are
came
some,
from her archives.
Those are so great.
But then Frances, she was sort of a mystery, and she, you know, she passed away. She didn't have children. But I started by interviewing her former colleagues. Mm-hmm. And all in all, I interviewed about a dozen of them.
Wow.
Yeah, and it was funny because, you know, they were from this kind of small world of Philadelphia at that time. And each person led me, you know, to a different clue, sort of. So, for example, some of these men who had worked with her belonged to, and still belong to, Marion Golf Club, which is a really tony, prestigious club. They had the U.S. Open there this year. And Frances really was the first woman to belong there without a husband. And these men took me there for lunch, and they're drinking martinis, and I feel like I really am Frances in this moment, you know? And they,
I wish I could hold my liquor like her.
Right, I know, I know. One of them is, like, sort of the king of the country club, you can tell. So after lunch, he says, okay, let's go up to the head office. So he takes me to the head office, and he says, we need to see the files for Frances Garrity. Now, I'm sure if I had asked for those on my own, they would have said, you know, buzz off.
And
but,
you are who?
Right, exactly. Yeah. But here they bring them out. And from that, you know, I found her home address. So then I went to her home, and I talked to the woman who had bought the house, and she invited me to come over, meet some of the neighbors who remembered Frances. So kind of unfolded and unfolded like that.
And so your research skills really feed this.
Yeah. And the, you know, in the book there are these memos, these confidential memos between De Beers and NWR.
Yes.
Those are real. And those memos, I knew they existed. I had heard of them. But I couldn't find them. And I looked and I looked and I looked. And different writers of nonfiction books about diamonds kind of led me on this wild goose chase saying, you know, one man said they're at Harvard. One man said they're at the Smithsonian. And I looked and looked. I could not find them.
Did
and
they
I
just
came,
tell you that to, like, set you up to try, or they just didn't want to sound like they didn't want to, they didn't know something. So they were just giving
the
you
latter,
an old answer.
I think that they had never actually seen them.
Yeah.
But they but they had written about them, so they wanted to feel as if they had or something. Mm. So I kind of gave up on them, but I really wanted to see them. I felt it would really change and add a lot of depth to her story.
Mm-hmm.
And because these memos, I mean, they were so juicy. They included all this stuff about the psychological examinations they were doing on men and women to find out, you know, how they could make them want these rings and the celebrities they were actually paying to wear the jewelry and all of this. So when I went to Frances' house 2 years after I started the book, the woman who bought the house had invited me for tea. I go over, we have tea, I meet the neighbors, it's great. As I'm leaving, the woman says, "Oh, by the way, Frances just left this one box behind when she moved, and I never got rid of it, and it contained all of these secret memos."
I just got chills.
I know. It was crazy. And it was like a day before the book was due to my editor, too, which was so funny. So it was really the bitter end. And
it was a long slog.
It was amazing. You know, I drove out to Pennsylvania that day, and because the book was really done already, I had sort of been thinking, is it really even worth going, you know, just to see what the house was like? But I thought,
fine,
might as well, right?
Yeah, I started, so I'll finish. Yeah,
right.
Kind of thing.
And it just was, I can't even explain to you the feeling when I was driving home that night. I pulled over in a grocery store parking lot, and I'm looking at all the memos, you know, under a street lamp. I mean, it was
so where amazing. Are those memos now?
So I,
in case anyone's asking,
I still have the memos, and my plan. I also came across photographs from Frances's childhood, and as I said, there's really no record of her out there.
Mm.
So at the archive at Radcliffe, they have an amazing collection of women who worked in advertising, and my plan is to make a collection for Frances and put the memos in it.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's really surprisingly intensely moving.
Oh, thank you. Yes.
You know, and that you would, you know, sort of honor that. And you can tell all those guys, well, actually, I know where they are now.
Exactly.
Nanny, nanny, bobo.
I know.
If you're still looking.
Exactly.
Yeah, they're here.
Right. And so I love the idea of them being in this archive that's all, you know, all women. Mm-hmm. The Radcliffe archive, it's only the papers of women. So,
it's incredible. I think you do an incredible job. I mean, because obviously this, you know, your research is intense, delved into research. I find a lot of writers, when they do that research, it's hard for them to step away from it.
Yes.
Your research seems to be seamlessly incorporated into the characters' sort of local knowledge.
Thank you.
You know, like from their perspective. It doesn't seem heavy-handed at all. And I'm amazed to hear how in-depth. Like, it's researched like a nonfiction book.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. That's pretty incredible.
That's so nice.
RadioGorgeous.com.
Also, well, I have, speaking of which, I have a question. I don't know if you've ever done this. This was part of your research. Delphine, your French character.
Ah, yes.
Has one of the most either horrifying or glorious revenge moments of all scorned women of all time.
Thank you. That's what an honor.
And yeah, I mean, just like, whoa, it's so over the top.
Yes.
And I'm not going to give anything away, but it's quite glorious. The dog is just...
The dog.
That's just... I was open-mouthedly shocked at the audacity.
You know, with the dog, I actually thought to myself, what is... Because I'm very attached to my dog. And I thought, what is the worst thing that someone could do to me?
I was going
to
say, was this a revenge fantasy of yours?
No, I was actually thinking about, and the dog really sticks with a lot of people, especially if they
love
dogs. Of
course. Yeah, exactly.
And
because you just wouldn't go there.
No. And, you know, every time, usually I find it very annoying when a writer says something like, you know, "Oh, I cried when I read the ending of my own book," or something. But I will say that every time I would come across that section when I was doing edits, I would just be sickened by it. So I thought that meant it was a good thing.
Yes, exactly. It was. If ever a scorned lover meant to give a sucker punch, it is totally the gut sucker punch.
Yeah. And it's funny because I have found, you know, when you're writing characters, you don't really assign them any sort of like value judgment. At least I don't. You know, there's so much conversation about whether characters are likable or unlikable, but I find that comes after the fact. It's almost like members of your own family. You know, you're stuck with them, so you're really not going to spend that much time wondering how likable they are or they are not. But with Delphine, I always find that, like, really well-behaved women who never make a fuss, would never send, you know, the suit back if it was cold or whatever, which is the type that I am, they love her because just the idea of doing what she did. I mean, I think everyone has had their heart broken and everyone has thought for a minute, I'm just going to ruin this person. But, you know, usually we don't do that. Yeah. But she does.
And comprehensively.
Yeah.
I suppose, which allows her to then continue on with her life in the way that she does.
Yes.
That she has so completely done something.
Yes.
Anyway, we will not ruin that because it is an absolute gem.
Thank you.
One thing I wanted to ask you about is that this story encompasses, you know, like we said, there's one ring. There's so many different characters and so many different threads. But actually, it just occurs to me whose ring that was.
Oh.
Oh, my God. See, it's still given. It's still given back to
me.
Oh,
good.
Okay. So it's more than five people's hands, actually. It's more like seven. Hmm. Yeah. Okay. Wow.
I like that.
Okay. Crazy. Right. Keep reading, people. Read it twice. Read it very carefully. Keeps giving to you. But it encompasses so many threads and so many stories. And it occurred to me that your first novel, Commencement, which was sort of a sort of modern The Group by Mary McCarthy.
Yeah.
And so I went to Vassar, so that's close to my heart, you know. And so I see that as, and again, so it's a group of people and you're following them all intimately. And your next book, Maine, it's one family, but there's a lot of them, you know, and there's three generations.
Yes.
For you, was the story not complete? I mean, is the connections and the connections and the connections? Is that just how you see stories? Is that how you see characters?
I think it must be, because every time I start, you know, thinking about a new novel, I think, well, this time I'm just going to have one protagonist, or maybe two.
And you're not very successful with that.
No, I'm not. I always end up with many, many, many. Maine initially had about probably 15 different, and I ended up pulling back and making it just four.
Yes, so whittled it down.
Yes, I am capable of some restraint. But I think for me, perception is such a huge thing, the way that we think we are moving through the world and the way that others see us moving through the world, and just like the misunderstandings that you were able to create when you have two characters reflecting on the same incident or the same, you know, lifespan or whatever it is. I think in this book it was a little different because with the first two, the characters were all connected. You know, in the first one they were a group of friends, and in the second, women in one family. So they were really bouncing off of each other so much. Whereas in this book, the reason there were so many was a little different. It was because I really wanted to look at the whole sort of world of marriage, all the things that bring us together, all the things that can go wrong, how marriage is affected by, you know, class and race and all of these different things. And also because same-sex marriage laws have been in the news so much when I started writing it, and still are, of course, and opponents of same-sex marriage kept saying, you know, that you cannot change marriage. It is carved in stone and the whole world will fall apart if you do.
When just in fact, like diamonds.
Right, exactly.
Diamonds, it's a construct like any other.
Yes, right. And in fact, marriage changes so much from one decade to the next. And, you know, we've seen this incredible change just in the last 50 years or so. I think, you know, when people are talking about this, I always think to myself, well, it's just a little over 40 years ago that a black man and a white woman could not get married in this country, or that a woman, you know, had to have her husband's permission to get a credit card. So actually, marriage has changed a lot. And also divorce becoming so much more common and something that's really not seen as shameful as it was, once was. So I just wanted
to necessarily change marriage.
Yeah.
The fact that you can end it.
That's right.
You know?
That's right.
Yeah.
So I wanted to write about all of that. And in order to do it, I had to have these couples who were really, really different and at different stages of the process, too.
Yeah. Wow. Well, it's a wonderful book.
Thank you.
I want to talk about Click.
Oh, yeah.
When we knew we were feminists.
Yeah, I said click earlier, didn't I?
Yes, you did. You know, that click moment. So when something clicks, as I assume is what you're referring to. There's a lot of talk here. I mean, you and I are both American. And I don't think, although I'm older than you, so for me, and I went to Vassar, I mean, which was my click moment, because it was the first time actually going to a former all-women's school was the first time I ever heard that women couldn't do something.
Right.
Now, you can't do that because you're a girl. And I was like, excuse me? Why on earth would that stop me from doing something? But to me, feminism has never been a dirty word. Just because why wouldn't you be?
Right.
You know, why wouldn't you want women to be paid equally and revered and championed, or at least held equal, of equal value, with equal input, etc.
Right.
But here it's become, almost a dirty word.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, associated with corduroy and not shaving.
Yeah.
And then I guess for young women it's confusing when there's so much here, you know, of... You know, there's still naked women, you know, in the paper on page 3.
Right.
There's, you know, and we're supposed to aspire to that,
right,
as well as be feminist. So I think there is a conflicting word. But so to you, I mean, why, you know, in a world where many women don't associate, they associate themselves with the precepts of feminism, but not the word.
Yeah.
Why to you is the word important, or is it?
Yeah, I mean, I think the word is important, and I was definitely raised by a mother who, just as you just described, was the kind of person who, to me, is a feminist. She always worked. She was, you know, very, and still is, very invested in her career, a very strong woman, very strong opinions, certainly not ever taking a back seat to her husband. But she wouldn't use the word feminist. She didn't like that word. She didn't think it defined, you know, or described who she was. And so actually it was when I was writing Commencement, which is a book that I think all of my novels have some sort of feminist element to them, but Commencement is the only one that really talks about feminism. The word is used a lot, and these women are actually trying very consciously to figure out, you know, what their feminist selves are going to be like, because they've gone to this women's college, they've experienced, you know, all the women's studies classes, but now they're out in the real world and they're trying to figure out, how does this work and what does it mean? And if I go on a date, do I expect him to pay? And if I do, does that mean I'm not a feminist? And all the little things that you don't necessarily
think about. How do you incorporate this in your life?
Exactly.
How do you live your life and still be a, you know, an attractive feminine person who wants to be with the opposite sex? Like, how do you incorporate those things? And I don't think we're taught how to incorporate them.
Exactly. And, you know, some women, I think, do come up in a world where they just naturally always call themselves feminists. But for many of us, there does have to be this moment where you decide to use the word. And there was a character in the book. There's sort of one of each of those characters in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And so the one who wouldn't have called herself one, sort of having this moment, this epiphany where she decides to use the word. And I sent out an email to maybe 10 of my friends who were all feminists, and I said, you know, do you remember why you started calling yourself a feminist? And somebody, I think, accidentally replied all, and then everyone started replying all, and it was very interesting because it really ran the gamut. And another friend of mine named Courtney Martin, who's a feminist writer, she said, you know, we should do an essay anthology about this. And so we ended up doing Click, the essay anthology, about young women, I think all in their 20s and 30s, writing about why they call themselves a feminist in an age when a lot of people think it's unnecessary or outdated or just, you know, evil or whatever it might be.
Mm-hmm.
And the title actually comes from this wonderful essay in the first ever issue of Ms. Magazine. It was by a writer named Jane O'Reilly, who now is a friend of mine. It was called The Housewife's Moment of Truth. And throughout it, these women are living their lives, and there's just a click, a click, a click. Why is it that I'm doing this and my husband's doing that? Why is it that, whatever it is?
That sort of raised consciousness moment.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Your head out of the oven moment.
Yeah. And you know, it was a really interesting project to do, and I think in a way, for some people, it is very organic. You can say there was a day, there was a minute that the light switch went on. For me, it wasn't like that. It was sort of a thing over time. I think that there were certain women I met along the way, an incredible teacher who's also a novelist who I had in high school, and then, you know, she was the first one to really talk about it and why the word mattered. And then going to Smith, which is a college really steeped in feminism, that it just came to a point where that was something I really wanted to identify with.
Yeah. Interesting.
But it really does, I mean, like you said, it really, I find that you know, having my books published in different countries is a really interesting experience, because last year I went on tour in Germany and France, and I was asked by every interviewer, you know, why on earth I wanted to use that word. I mean, people were
really?
People were very clear about the fact that they just didn't understand.
Wow.
Which was interesting. Well, it's funny, I got an email the other day from an Italian reader. He said, "My wife and I love your book, Maine, so much. And we really feel it's unfair that you've been described as a feminist author." They said that it really diminishes you.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, that's really
limiting.
Funny.
Yeah. You know, you're limited to that. Yeah. Oh, poor you.
I know.
Wow. It's really funny. Yeah, it's just, it's not something, I've only been examining it recently because it has come up here.
Yes.
And not in a way that I would have, you know, living in New York, that I think it would have ever come up.
Yeah. Although it does come up, you know, I did a reading recently at a library in Massachusetts where I'm from. And usually when I am touring for a novel, the feminist thing doesn't really get mentioned. Or if it does, it gets mentioned by someone who's curious because they consider themselves a feminist. They want to talk about that. But this was a woman who was sort of demanding that I explain what I meant by that, what I thought feminist meant. Mm. And I asked her, and she was really angry, you know, it was weird. And I asked her what she thought it meant after I said what I thought it meant. And she just said, "I don't know, and that's why. You know, I've never called myself that because I think I just don't, you know, quite understand what people are talking about," sort of. Right. So there is a huge divide everywhere.
This has been a Radio Gorgeous production for RadioGorgeous.com. Get in contact with us, contact us on info@RadioGorgeous.com, and to sign up for our shows to come once a week into your inbox. Who can think of anything better, darling?